Hello and welcome to Real Living. We are switching gears. We just had an interminable series on discipleship, on leadership, which I thought was just, I'm remembering some of the things that we talked about, Mary Lou, like the fact that government and family are the primary institutions. I think that'll also inform kind of what we're going to talk about today, which is a great article, which it will be posted to our podcast page on our Redbox Media website under the show Real Living. There's an article written by Monsignor Pope, Charles Pope, back in 2016, so less than a year ago. And he's using Alexander Teitler's 8 stages of the rise and fall of civilization. So I thought that was kind of cool. I'd like to kind of use that as sort of a jumping off point for our discussion today. I went through the Italian school system, and we learned something similar in the Italian school system in philosophy and in history. And it was not exactly a Scottish scholar like Alexander Teitler, but it was an Italian historian by the name of Giambattista Vico. And Vico said that all history is cyclical, and that patterns just, and that's funny. Impression. I learned that stuff in high school, and yet it's kind of become part of my philosophical infrastructures to kind of recognize that nothing is really going to stay, and that everything is kind of cyclical. Now, not obviously cyclical in the pantheistic way, for instance, of Far Eastern religions, for instance, that consider that history is the wheel of time and that there's no breaking out of it. That we're not talking about it in that sense. What we're talking about it is that the human condition, the human fallen condition, leads to certain cycles in history. And the first thing when I read this article, Mary Lou, and maybe you'll remember, it brought me back to the book of Judges. Mm-hmm. The cycles in the book of Judges.
Right.
Sin, supplication, salvation. No, sin, slavery, supplication, salvation. Sin, slavery, supplication, salvation. It was sin brings them into bad times, which brings them into slavery. And, you know, to the various ites, the Ammonites, the Amalekites, all the various enemies of the people of Israel in the book of Judges. And then they would call, they would become supplicants and call upon the name of the Lord, who would send, quote, a judge, Samson, Gideon, whoever. And then they would be saved to salvation.
Right.
But then they would become arrogant and complacent and all these things that Alexander Teitler is saying here. And then they would fall back into sin, which then would fall back into slavery and bondage. Does that make sense?
Which describes the human condition.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's also, and another thing that struck me was that it's similar like that in the spiritual life.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes, you know, we all know that great times of suffering often are the crucible within which great conversion is born, right? So from great, you know, why do we say that God allows suffering? Well, God allows suffering, I think, also because it's one of the most tried and true instruments to bring us to Him.
That's like when sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. I mean, right. You know, we, in these times, we're waiting for our great saints to rise.
That's right. So, anyway, we can have a great moment of conversion that is brought on by suffering. The great conversion leads to all kinds of spiritual riches and peace and harmony. But then what happens? There's a risk of becoming complacent, you know, and I think that perhaps complacency is one of the greatest risks of the Christian life, because like we all know, there's no such thing as treading water in, either you grow or you fall back or you're backsliding. Right.
Right.
So I thought this was kind of a very interesting way of looking at history. And in my experience, it's always been clear. Now, what is Monsignor Pope's argument? You know, when philosophers like Vico and Teitler and all those guys talk about the cycles of history, it's not necessarily a very hopeful point of view. It's more like, hey, guys, we're stuck in this cycle. But I like Monsignor Pope's take is, you know what? We're stuck in the cycle, but the church has been there from the very beginning. And before the church, there was the old covenant, and God has always had a structure in place for the faithful as we survive these cycles of history.
So and God has been the constant always.
I thought that's one of the differences that I noticed in this article presenting these stages, is that the other theories, yes, they're true. We could recognize that they're true, but we have hope. And right. I like this article because it kind of gave us hope, you know? Mm-hmm. Cultures and civilizations go through cycles. Over time, many civilizations and cultures have risen and then fallen. We who live in painful times like these do well to recall these truths. Cultures and civilizations come and go, but only the church, of course, always in need of reform, obviously, and the true biblical culture remains. So only what you do for Christ will last. Yes, all else passes, but the church is like an ark passing on the waters of this world and in the floodwaters of times like these. So there's always hope, is I guess what we're trying to say.
And that's really what we need in today's time, is that hope. So this is a really good reflection on, you know, that constant, the church, which really doesn't, the structure of the church, the truthfulness of the church does not change.
And, you know, you may not agree with his assessment here, but what he's saying in this article, Monsignor Pope is saying that, hey, guess what, guys? It was nice while it lasted, but we seem to be at the end of a cycle ourselves right now. Now, I don't know. This is not a political discussion. I would like this to be more of a spiritual discussion that kind of looks at our culture with a sobering mind. So we don't want to be Pollyannas seeing that everything is fine and everything's hunky-dory, because I'm sorry, I don't care what part of the political spectrum you're on, things are not fine in our world today, not just in the United States, but in the West in general. It appears now, he says, that we are at the end of an era. We are in a tailspin that we don't seem to be able to pull ourselves out of. Greed, aversion to sacrifice, secularism, divorce, promiscuity, and the reform and the deepening darkness and the destruction of the most basic unit of the civilization, the family, do not make for a healthy culture. So we talked about that in our unit on leadership, remember? Anything
right.
that's going to that is destroying the family and also barring the doors to the influence of the church in society. So the two primary human institutions, right? Without which there can be no human flourishing.
That's right.
Right?
It creates disorder.
That means that there is that does not make it for a healthy culture. There seems to be no basis for true reform, and the deepening darkness suggests that we are moving into the last stages of a disease. So tell us what you really think, Monsignor Pope. But he, I like how he says, this is painful but not unprecedented. And he obviously refers to Alexander Titler. It's kind of Alexander's name is misspelled here. He spells it T-Y-L-E-R, but it's actually T-Y-T-L-E-R. And he was a Scottish lord who taught at the University of Edinburgh he died in 1813. But he noted, and so I like the distance that he has also from us, because he's recognizing some constants that really don't need to be in the present era to recognize those cycles, right?
Right.
So basically what he said is, he wrote this book in which he presented this theory of this history in stages. And like I said before, that's not a new idea. I myself have studied a different form of it. So he says there's different stages, eight different stages, and I'm sure we could probably parse them out maybe a little bit more, a little bit less. But I think these things are going to probably resonate with us out there. So the first stage is from bondage to spiritual growth, from bondage to spiritual growth. So his point is great civilizations are formed in a crucible. So and one of the examples that he brings, obviously, is the United States, you know, the American Revolution, you know, the oppression, the British oppression, the American Revolution. That was a crucible of suffering. It brought about this new experiment in American democracy, which he considers to be growth. But before that, we had other examples. The ancient Jews were in bondage in Egypt. The Christian faith in the church came out of 300 years of persecution. And also, I thought it was interesting, and it's so true, us, you know, us people of European descent, we are basically the descendants of the Romans intermarried with the barbarians. None of us is a true, pure Roman. There, all the influx and the trouble and the turmoil of the barbarians. I mean, you see any kind of sword and sandal drama on TV, or any kind of historical fiction playing out in a so-called medieval, you know, low Middle Ages or high Middle Ages sort of looking environment, like, for instance, Game of Thrones or any of these Tudor things that you see on television, etc. A lot of them are also fantasy. They're made up. But the point is that there are times when there are intense movements of people where a more civilized society has become complacent and is falling to the barbarians. But within two or three generations, the people that emerges is stronger because it's the original people plus the new blood of the barbarians. And that is what modern Europe is.
Well, when you're talking about, you know, blending the cultures, you know, in the early church, they tried to take the customs that were present there and Christianize them so that, you know, those people would not lose everything. There would be some identity with a place or a custom, but we would put that Christian text to it and make it our own. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in many holidays and so forth, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the success of the church. It's not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, but how can we meld these things to make it truly Christian?
Well, it's evangelize the culture. That's our mission. But his point on this first cycle, this first stage, is suffering brings wisdom and demands a spiritual discipline that seeks justice and solutions.
That's what the martyrs are, the seed of the church.
Yeah, exactly. And also, but in our own lives, I want to draw some parallels in the Christian life in general. We may have great moments of conversion, but I think it's probably at that moment when you are at rock bottom in intense suffering that you really see your complete and utter dependence on God. And you also see that the Lord emphasizes different priorities. You know?
Well, your vision becomes far more clear in those moments when you're not dependent upon yourself or the culture or anything else, where you're to the point where you have to depend on God because that's all that's left at that very moment.
That's right. Well, and sometimes that's just kind of the way it is. So again, I think it's important for us to know that suffering does have a role in our life, and that, yes, the Lord does want us to feel good and to be good. But sometimes because of our fallen nature, the only thing that's going to work is a crucible experience. And so that's drawn into the historical comparison as well. So the first stage, he said, is from bondage. So from suffering, from persecution, from wars. In the case of the United States, it was injustice, you know, injustice to taxation without representation, you know, all that stuff, right?
Right.
So that brings about justice and solutions. So in this case, for instance, in what he's talking about, the United States, there was the emergence of this incredibly new experiment of a Republican democracy, right?
And if you recall what Robert George said, he said, you know, you could go to Italy and become a citizen, but you're not really Italian. You could come to America, become a citizen, and you become an American. Mm-hmm. It's that blending here of those cultures. You were no longer Italian or French or Irish or whatever it may be. You became American. And that's right. Quite unusual.
It's that great melting pot. One of Alexander Teitler's points also, but it's ascribed to him, but Alexis de Tocqueville may have said it as well, but they're both observers of the culture about the same period. They said that democracy really inherently is not stable. It's not a stable form of government. Why? Because democracy depends on the moral actions of the people who inhabit it. So like what Washington and Adams said at the beginning of our nation, they said, we are a nation of laws, but those laws are only for people who have moral compasses, because you can't make people do stuff just because it's the law. They have to know it in. They have to be willing participants that they are going to sustain the law. Does that make sense? So
it
that's
makes
why all
perfect
these laws
sense.
That passed about preventing this and stopping that and this and that and the other. It's just an accretion of more and more barnacles of legislation on top of a body politic that has completely forgotten what a moral foundation is, that actually disputes the need for a moral foundation. So that's why democracy, unfortunately, is not inherently stable. It depends upon the moral intelligence and the uprightness of its citizens. So because of that, the second stage presented here is from spiritual growth to great courage. Having been steeled in the crucible of suffering, courage and the ability to endure great sacrifice, anointed leaders emerge. George Washington, St. Paul and St. Peter, Charlemagne, whoever you can think of great leaders in history, right?
Right.
And are summoned to courage and sacrifice, including loss of life, in order to create a better, more just world for succeeding generations. I don't know about you, Mary Lou, if you in high school, but I know we did, and they shoved that thing down our throats so many times. There, we had to study epic poetry in the Italian system, epic poems. And the Chanson de Roland, the Song of Roland, was one of the ones.
Oh, yes. I remember.
Middle school, in high school, in elementary school. And it was all about the heroism of this Roland, of Roland. And this was like in the 900s, the thousands. You know, it's a troubadour song. It's like a chanson de geste, a song of action, a song of a romantic song. And the whole idea was that this Roland or Roland perishes in a pass in the Pyrenees along with his entire army, but manages to bar the way to the enemy. And, you know, the guy's been dead for over 1,000 years. And yet still, the song that memorizes his heroic coming in and taking responsibility and saying this far, but no farther, you know, that kind
right.
of thing. That's the kind of anointed leader that emerges during times of great trouble. So hopefully we're all on the same page so far, right? So people who have little or nothing also have little or nothing to lose. So look, for instance, at the American revolutionaries. A lot of the revolutionaries came in from the mountains of North Carolina with not much to their name, right?
Right.
The people who were the landed gentry, the ones who sided with the British, remember?
Right. And you can also go back and think about the Second World War, where they were fighting for freedom for people that were invaded, for the Jews, for everyone. It was a moral war in many ways. Mm-hmm. And people were willing to sacrifice their lives, you know, going from America and different countries where we really could have stayed untouched. But yet we wanted to go in and you know, be those people that would fight for what was right. Mm-hmm. And moral and just, and it was a time of real self-sacrifice for many people, those that were left behind and those that went and fought in the war.
Well, that's what they call it, the greatest generation, right? I mean, because that's
right.
The last generation that had an idea about courage, discipline, self-denial.
That really, it probably is.
You know, no, I shouldn't say that. I mean, you know, us baby boomers, hopefully, and even the millennial. I mean, you know. Those are not qualities only in a certain generation, but they seem to be fostered in certain kinds of environments. And environments in which there is way too much stuff and there is complacency are not environments that are going to birth courage, discipline, self-denial, deferred gratification. Just not going to happen,
right.
As a rule, right? So you have this spiritual growth, second phase, spiritual growth to great courage. So that's how the environment of suffering produces these heroes. So for instance, let's say the 300 years of persecution of the church were the breeding ground for the conditions that brought about the emergence of a great leader like, for instance, Constantine, who emerged at the right place at the right time and was able to bring the ban and remove the ban off of the Christian church. So that would be just another example, okay? So then from great courage, so from suffering to spiritual growth to great courage, the third stage is from courage, the courage that has just been, you know, we've just obtained through the spiritual growth, to liberty. That's stage three. As a result of the courageous fight, the foe is vanquished. So the British are thrown out, the church comes out of the catacombs, The Jews are delivered from Israel by Moses, the anointed leader, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So many examples. And greater justice emerges. You know, the Israelites get to inhabit the land of Canaan. The Americans get to set up their democracy, and so forth and so on. Okay. Many who lead the battle, who had led the battles in the past, are still alive, and the legacy of those who are not are still fresh. Look, for instance, at the fathers of the American experiment, right? The fathers of our country. Heroism and the virtues that brought about liberty are still esteemed. Look, for instance, the Constitution and then the various constitutional conventions that carried on afterwards. The people who brought the first few amendments within the first 50 years, for instance, of the life of the United States. Washington, Adams, Jefferson, all those guys died, but their spirit is brought forward. Those ideals that were struggled for during the years of the Crucible are still very largely agreed upon. Does that make sense?
Right. And we're not going in and changing them. They're holding fast.
Yeah. Nobody's coming in and saying, hey, guys, let's remove the word God from the Constitution.
Exactly.
Like, or, hey, guys, let's remove In God We Trust from all our currency. Or, hey, guys, let's remove the cross from the city seal in, you know, 500 of these cities across the country. Like, unfortunately, is happening now. Everybody was pretty much on the same page as to what needed to happen to achieve the excellence that they were looking for, because they were coming from the Crucible of Suffering. So from spiritual growth to great courage, from courage to liberty, things are being achieved. So then there's the next step is the tricky step. Because then from liberty, then you have freedom. So let's look at what happened, for instance, in this country, the United States, in the aftermath of the Second World War. The First World War and the Second World War were two of the worst events ever to befall humanity. Millions and millions and millions of people died. Whole generations were wiped out in the First World War and in the Second World War. And yet the things that they fought for came to pass. And so liberty was achieved. And so they came home, and then you have the great economic boom, right, in the United States, and the prosperity, where the late 40s give in to the great prosperity and affluence of the 50s. So stage four, from liberty to abundance. Liberty ushers in greater prosperity because civilization is still functioning with the virtues of sacrifice and hard work. But then comes the first danger, abundance. Things that are in too great an abundance tend to weigh us down and take on a life of their own. Remember, it was like, I forgot who it was, somebody who was saying about how they worked all their life to achieve stuff. When they finally got their stuff, they had to hire people to watch their stuff. And then they hired people to watch the people who were watching their stuff. And then they had to hire lawyers and accountants and, you know, everything.
It goes on and on and on.
To watch your stuff. Because right. After a while, your stuff starts to own you instead of you owning your stuff, right? Abundance.
Right. So it becomes more of a burden than a joy at that point. You're managing everything.
If it's not perceived properly.
Correct.
Things that are in too great an abundance tend to weigh us down. At the same time, the struggles that engender wisdom and steal the soul to proper discipline and priorities move to the background because, hey, you got to manage all this stuff. Jesus said that a man's life does not consist in his possessions. Well, you could, that would be like a radical truth to announce on social media, wouldn't it? What? Well, that does not consist in our Maserati? Are you kidding me?
Well, it becomes our identity. What do we have? That puts us in a certain strata. It's that's how we're defined by what we have, where we live, that sort of thing, which is ridiculous.
Such a culture is living on the fumes of earlier sacrifice. Its people become less and less willing to make such sacrifices. Ideals diminish in importance, and abundance weighs down the souls of the citizens. The sacrifices, discipline, and virtues responsible for the thriving of the civilization are increasingly remote from the collective consciousness. And listen to this. This is the main sentence. The enjoyment of their fruits becomes the focus. So if you're to use an example in recent history, you go from the transition of the great boom in wealth of the 50s to the revolution of the 60s. The generation, the baby boomers that come of age in the 60s are the ones who push the envelope on many moral levels. Remember, don't trust the establishment. Remember that whole don't trust anybody over the age of 30?
Absolutely. I lived right through it. I was in D.C. for some of the marches. I mean, I remember all of this stuff, and everything was changing so quickly that you as an individual against the establishment, against the government, because, you know, they were not in your best interest. You could decide what was best.
Yeah, it was a radical autonomy and individualism that led, obviously, to the sexual revolution. You know, starting in 1965, accelerating in 1967. Remember, say 1968, the Summer of Love, and all that stuff. So, but I guess one of Monsignor Pope's points here is, hey, if they had still been having to worry about where their next meal came from, if they hadn't had all this, still all this abundance, they wouldn't have been worrying about don't trust anybody over 30. They would have had to trust somebody over 30 because their lives depended upon it. But it's there's that trap of abundance where the enjoyment of their fruits becomes the focus. And then from there you go to the worst step, not one of the worst steps, but it's obviously you can see how that happens, which is complacency. Stage five, from abundance to complacency. To be complacent means to be self-satisfied and increasingly unaware of serious trends that undermine health and the ability to thrive. Does that sound like what we're going through today?
I mean,
it's probably going through a worse stage now, but you can see how that began. Everything looks fine, so it must be fine. And that's, I think,
that's the vacuum that we live in today.
Well, that's an earlier time too, because everything doesn't look fine anymore.
But remember, I'm okay, you're okay type of thinking.
That was 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So you're cool, you're fine, blah, blah. But now nobody really looks like they're fine or anything like that. Yet foundations, resources, infrastructures, and necessary virtues are all crumbling. As virtues, disciplines, and ideals become ever more remote, those who raise alarms are labeled by the complacent as killjoys and considered extreme, harsh, or judgmental. Remember what happened in the 60s? Hey, man, don't be square. What was the worst possible thing? That you would be considered square, that you would be considered a prude, that you would be considered somebody who is an establishment type, right?
That's exactly right.
But that you have the luxury to do that when you have shifted from abundance to complacency, because at this point, you just take abundance for granted.
Well, they were striving for utopia without any God present in it. So it was everybody... miserable lives, quite frankly.
I had an example of the contrast of people coming from extreme sacrifice and being blindsided by the culture of abundance and as you know, I grew up with an aunt and an uncle. My aunt, well, and my uncle too, lived in Rome during the Second World War. They remember people eating rats and cats. Mm. And dogs, if they could find them. They remember people starving. They remember people being picked out by the Nazis and thrown up against a wall and shot. I mean, they remember, and my aunt, God bless her, she's like 96 right now, 97, she's still alive. I remember going to restaurants with her, and she would empty the contents of the sugar packets and the butters, the small butters they put on, everything in her purse. It would be the idea that we don't know when we're going to get more.
Well, that's like
still had that mentality, right? Like the bread, we ate every single crumb of the last crust, even if it was so hard you needed a drill to get through it. You know, that kind of thing.
Well, and that reminds me of my parents grew up during the Depression when people didn't have anything. So as they married and started to raise their family, they were very careful about being very frugal about different things because they knew what it was like not to have anything. Mm-hmm. And that stayed with them. And it's of course, it's kind of lost in today's world, I think. But that made such an impression on them, just like with your aunt, what they had to do to survive the war.
And how that mentality, also my husband tells me his father also, who lived through a certain part of the war, had that kind of, there's not going to be enough. What are we going to do? You know, that kind of almost like a panicked idea that the future is not abundance. The future could be deprivation. So, and what are we going to do about it? So Our time has run away with us, and we're only really at stage five. So we're going to continue with our list on this great article by Monsignor Pope called The Eight Stages of the Rise and Fall of Civilizations that you can find on LifeSite News, but will also be posted through our podcast page on Breadbox Media. Thank you for joining us.